Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Hey there. Before we get going today, I want to give you guys a few discount codes for our products and our show sponsors. So please don't just zip through this. If you're listening to the podcast, we at Hardwick Life want to reward you for your loyalty. So take 25% off your order of any of our products at hardwick.life by using the code HardwickFF25. That's HardwickFF25. Because we consider you friends and family. That's FF. That's Hardwick FF25. And the website is hardwick.life. It's like hardwick.com, but it's hardwick.life. In case you've missed it, we've lowered the price of that Lose Like a Lineman and Lose Like a Lady program all the way down to just $25. That's a one-time fee. It's not monthly. It's not recurring. And yes, because you listen to this podcast, that Hardwick FF25 code will take 25% more off of that. So if you want me to do the math for you, that's $18.75. And the Facebook support group is now $0. Why? Because I get a bigger kick out of seeing people reclaim their health and reclaim their lives than I do making money. So why not make it free, Nick? That's what you may ask. Because I do believe it has to sting a little bit in order for you to make it happen. If it's free, you're going to treat it like it's free, which means it's going to end up in the recycle bin. The psychological term for that would be called the opt-in. Also, thank you to the show sponsors and products that I've been using for years now. Bubs Naturals and Julian Bakery, both are tremendous products. I highly recommend them both. For 20% off of Bubs Naturals, use the code HARDWICK20 at BubsNaturals.com. And for 10% off of Julian Bakery, use code Nick Hardwick. That's just my name. Nick Hardwick at JulianBakery.com. And lastly, if you love this show and it benefits your life in any way at all, even if it's a tiny way, please rate and review us wherever you listen to the show. Something as simple as a 5-star rating, not asking too much, and a love this show, Jamie is the best, will help boost our rating so more people can see us. And who knows, maybe their life gets better too. Thank you guys. Now let's get to the show. Hey gang, what's going on? Welcome to the Hardwick Life Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Hardwick. We've got an awesome guest today, one of my favorite authors. I've read three of her books, Kelly McGonigal. She's a health psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University. She is known for her work in the field of science help, which focuses on translating insights from psychology and neuroscience into practical strategies that support health and well-being, happiness, and personal success. Seems like we're all striving for that. Kelly holds a BA in psychology and a Bachelor of Science in Mass Communications from Boston University, as well as a PhD from Stanford University, where she is a lecturer in psychology and a leading expert in the new field of science help. She's authored 5 books, including international bestseller, The Willpower Instinct, How Self-Control Works, Why It Matters, and What You Can Do to Get More of It, The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It, and her latest work, The Joy of Movement, How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, Connection, and Courage. Personally, Kelly is one of my favorite authors. Her work has allowed me to more effectively manage my own internal struggles as well as help guide others in their journeys, including those in the Lose Like Alignment program and even my own children, honestly. I'm a big audiobook guy. I think a lot of you know that, finding that I retain information better when I listen as I'm working out. And I used to be a pump-up music guy, but now when the brain is firing, either on a walk or lifting weights, I really prefer it to absorb as much information as possible. So Kelly's work ties science and stories together to help that information stick. And she reads the books that she wrote herself, except the first one. And I got to ask her about that, because she's got a great voice. You'll hear it. So interviewing her today, it really feels like I'm meeting one of my heroes. It's super cool. So we're going to cover exercise as medicine, how stress can be a good thing, and how to build more willpower. Some of the old paradigms, they've been thrown to the wayside with Kelly's cutting-edge mindset interventions, as she describes them. I highly recommend her books. You can find her on Twitter and Facebook at Kelly McGonigal. That's McGonigal. and her personal website is kellymcgonigal.com. Hope you enjoy, guys. All right, Kelly, thank you so much for the time today. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am super. Where are you at? You in Palo Alto?
I am in Palo Alto at home.
Yeah. And what does a normal day look like for you now?
Good question. So wake up in the morning. First thing that I do is I get my cold brew coffee out of the fridge and do a workout. So this morning I did a 30-minute HIIT on my bike.
Awesome.
And then I start engaging with the rest of my life. So on any given day, I might teach one or two movement classes and then prep for other stuff I'm doing, like the academic class that I'm teaching this spring at Stanford, or talks that I'm giving. And I also am working on a new book. So I'll spend a couple hours today doing research, reading studies, mapping out ideas. So I'd say like my day is half movement, half mind.
Yeah. Very cool. All right. Don't let me forget at the end. I want to ask you about this new book because I think I'm fired up already.
Oh, wait, so, you would be the first person I would tell publicly. So we'll have to, even my publisher, we don't have a contract. So I'll give you a hint.
Okay, good. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I want to ask like, what's that? Like with the whole process, how many years do you allocate for this?
Yeah, because it's years. I mean, I've been working on this book already for a year and a half and I haven't even formally started. Every book is like a 5-6 year project.
Wow. Yeah, that's the crazy thing that I heard about books. At some point, one person was like, you know, you can read a blog, sure, and it took 2 days or 3 days or whatever. Like books take some people 15 years to have all that information laid out. So super cool. All right. We're all like, you know, we all are who we are because of where we came from and how we were born and the parents we were raised by and the environment we're in and all that. So here's a really full question. How'd you become the person you are today?
You know, I feel like one thing that I really value about myself is that I did seem to be born with some very strong instincts, both instincts that have been not easy to live with, like anxiety, but also instincts and intuitions that were really powerful about what I love, trying to understand other people, loving music and movement and wanting to help people. Like, so those instincts were really powerful. And I would say that if you were to ask, how did I become who I am? It probably is this mix of those competing instincts, you know, being born somebody who has a tendency to be anxious, fearful, overwhelmed, and also living with chronic pain since I was a kid. So there was like this, I came out already suffering, and then also this really strong desire to understand what it means to be human and to help people. And so when you combine that, that's how you end up on the path, I think, to becoming a health psychologist who's interested in the mind-body relationship. And then in terms of environment, one thing I always point to, my parents were both classroom teachers. And they really supported both me and my sister in exploring our interests. They allowed me to take art classes and fashion design classes and dance classes alongside the traditional, like, you know, strong academic focus. And they did the same thing with my sister, who was interested in games and computer games growing up. And, you know, then she became a game designer. So there was something about how my parents, they were willing to see what lit us up and support us pursuing those things instead of saying, okay, but you have to put all your focus on math or English or like those traditional goals, that was really important in learning to trust myself, so that when I wanted to do something that was not traditional in my career path, I could trust myself to follow that path instead of doing what would be the more expected route.
So you and your sister, you're twins, right?
Identical.
How cool is that?
It's very cool. It's like so having cool. Another version of myself out in the world.
But I think the cool thing is you're both very independently successful and in completely different realms. So as a parent, I've got a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old boy, and they're so different. All kids are so different. I'm different from my brother. My wife's so different from her 4 brothers and sisters, right? How did your parents navigate that in helping you guys explore what you were passionate about, and how'd they even identify that? or how did, I guess you came out knowing a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is my sister and I have very strong personalities. So I think we told them. But you know, I think, you know, this is a really silly example, but we, being identical twins, we were expected to dress the same. And when I was maybe 7 or 8, I was like, I want to look like this girl from Kids Incorporated. I want to be a rock star. I want to be like Madonna. And they let me cut my hair and bleach my hair in like second grade for, I don't know how young I was. And so we didn't look the same anymore. And I think that they were very, they very consciously allowed us to identify the things that we were uniquely passionate about and differentiate in that way, without making us compete against each other a lot. And, but, you know, it's, this is something I, because I get this question a lot, and I know that underlying this question is often the desire or the belief that as a parent, you can control how your kids turn out. And remember, I'm a psychologist. So I know the research. I mean, sure, I can thank my parents. I have a good life and I hope I'm contributing to the world, but, that doesn't mean that you as a parent can control whether your kids suffer, whether your kids succeed, who they become. And I think it's actually really important to acknowledge that, that you're, you know, this is part of what it means to be human, is that every human being comes into the world with their own DNA and in some way their own destiny. And a parent's job is really to try to be responsive, but also to understand that you're not in control.
That's beautiful. And that's how I feel about that. I got great advice from a very successful neighbor once who said, your job as a parent is to help your kids not need you. But then it's, for me, it's also helping them become what they want to be and what maybe they're, like you said, destined to be. I think that is super awesome. So I never would have thought this about you. So tell me about this group fitness thing. Like I just thought it was like, what a dichotomy. I mean, you got a PhD in psychology, you got a lecturer, you got a best-selling author, you speak all over the place, you're helping companies. And
I mean, I'm sure it's a little bit like knowing you want to be an athlete. I mean, you know, I grew up in the 80s. There, it was the era of aerobics. There's sort of, you know, this archetype of somebody who's full of energy and life and gets to move to music and a room full of people. And as a kid, I wanted that. And I started doing workout videos, you know, at home in my basement and then in the living room, these like VHS tapes my mom would bring home from garage sales. And I just loved it. I loved moving to the beat of music. I loved moving in synchrony with other people. I loved the leotards and all of it. It was like, you know, it was as close to the disco as I could get as a little kid. And that just continued to be true for me. And, you know, by the time I was in graduate school for psychology, my first year, actually I took a class the summer after my first year in graduate school. It was called The Psychology of Shyness, but it was really for people who are dealing with anxiety. It is a very sort of sneaky title. And the main project for that class was to do something that scared you that you'd been putting off because of fear. And so I made my goal that in that class to audition to be a group fitness instructor at Stanford. And so by the end of the summer, I was hired and I've never stopped. It's the thing I do that brings me the most joy. I know that positive movement experiences change lives. I see how it builds community. It was the worst part of COVID when everything was shut down was not being able to teach in person for 6 months, and getting back to it as soon as possible is absolutely what has continued to get me through things. So, you know, I feel like, and in many ways, so my most recent book is a little bit about the science of why movement is so important for connection and community and mental health and happiness. And I feel like that's finally where I got to bring those two sides of myself together. The part that is just passionate. I want my daily experience. I want every day to just move. I want to move to music and move with other people and feel my heart pound and sweat and challenge myself and elevate people, you know, through an amazing playlist. That's what I want to do. And the science of it is just fascinating. But in part, it's like, I always tell people, I want to understand the science in order to do things more effectively. So, you know, whatever the topic has been in my career, whether it's behavior change and willpower or stress and resilience or movement and exercise, you know, the science is, it's fascinating, but it's always in service of like, let's help people be happy and healthy and help myself be happier and healthier. So.
What was that anxiety like? And then pushing through that to actually get the job and for the audition. Yeah.
I mean, it's so funny because, you know, I remember I didn't have a lot of experience. I had a lot of experience with anxiety at that time, but I didn't have tremendous coping skills. So up until that point, I was still using avoidant coping for a lot of things. Like if I was overwhelmed by something, I wouldn't go. You know, I missed out on a lot of stuff when I was in college because I would get anxious and panic and just not go, not show up to things or pull out of opportunities because I didn't know, I couldn't guarantee that I would be able to do it. So I just wouldn't try. So I remember, but this was so important to me. And it's funny because right the minute before I auditioned and I was standing outside, I just had such a strong compulsion to go home, to just walk back to my dorm room and pretend like it had never happened so that I wouldn't have to feel what I was feeling, which is sort of the root of all avoidance coping, whether you're eating or drinking or procrastinating or quitting things that are meaningful to you. And, you know, because it was so important to me, it was like this self-defining moment. I stayed and I auditioned, and that audition was kind of a blur, but I remember the first actual class I taught, which was a dance class. And I remember about 20 minutes into it, I felt like I was conducting an orchestra. Like, you know, I was being my true self, leading people in movement across the floor, and the music was amazing. And I literally heard a voice in my head say, like, this is what I was born to do. And that's when I mentioned earlier, this one of the things that I really love about myself is my strong instinct and intuition. I love that I do have a voice inside me that will say something like that I can then lean on when things get tricky.
I've got this same voice. And actually, you know, in hindsight, we look back at our lives and it's like, oh, it was all sunshine and rainbows and everything. But as you're talking about standing outside the class, you're like, just go home. This isn't for you. You know, all the anxiety and the pressure building up and everything. And then you go and it's just a total blur. My whole football career, I thought the exact same thing. Like I was sharing with my kids the other day, there were plenty of times driving to work that because of the stress and the pressure and all of that, I was like, I wish that truck would just hit me right now and like just make me not show up to work. And I threw up, honestly, I threw up because of anxiety before every single game that I played. And it was like, it became a funny thing with the team.
Yeah, I call that the cleanse. I don't quite do that, but I've had some similar experiences with anxiety before public speaking. And you just have to find a way, like, this is how my body lets me know that this is really meaningful to me. And one of the things that has been important to me is to let people know you can't always fix everything. Like, you can't control it. You could have decided that if you couldn't control that part of your physical reaction, or you couldn't control your emotions and make them exactly what you wanted them to be, like, why couldn't you be the person who was just totally confident and every moment was glorious? Well, you don't always get to choose that, but you still get to choose what's meaningful. And you can, sure, you can work on things, but it doesn't mean this idea that we have to be the perfect version of ourselves the way we think it's meant to be in order to do the thing that we're meant to do, I think really gets in people's way. So,
yeah, I completely agree with that, because when I stepped onto the field and I started fighting, I thought the exact same thing. I was like, I'm born for this. Like, I was made to do this. But even getting there in the hotel room, I'm like, oh my gosh, I just can't wait till my career's over. I can't wait to go home. I can't wait till and it's like, it's so.
I think that there are people who have that and people who don't. And I think it's some innate human tendency that it's hardwired in some of us, because I have the same thing. And I know that a lot of people have this. It's this internal resistance that is always thinking, when is it going to be over? Or how do I get out of this? Even when something is deeply meaningful and you know you're going to enjoy it, or you know you're going to be glad that you did it. And then there are some people who don't seem to have that. And I definitely feel like when I think about who my audience is, I feel like I'm talking to people who really their entire lives, they've had these kind of competing instincts, and that part of how they become their best selves is to accept and find ways to work with inner experiences that they can't control. And it could be things like chronic pain or anxiety or resistance, or, you know, just other impulses, things like addiction, where we would love to be able to just get rid of all of that, or even things like grief. You don't get to just sort of clean the slate. But I am aware that there are some people who have a very different lived experience, and I wonder what that's like.
I do too, because I thought everybody had the same thing. And then I talked to one of my teammates, and he said he doesn't get nervous before a game. I said, you don't get nervous before you play a football game? And he's like, no, it's just fun for me. And I thought, oh my goodness, how incredible that must be, because I'm with you. I think I was hardwired completely the other way. And then too, I think there's a component, and I did learn that was just part of the ride. That was just for me. That was going to be part of the ride. And then we talk a lot about mental health and everything. And everybody goes through highs and lows, I think. And maybe it's the same kind of thing. Not everybody does. But for me, kind of those lows are just part of the ride. And I had to learn to really accept those lows and some of those downtimes to be able to maybe experience some of the better times. I think as an athlete, like, why your books maybe resonate so much with me is I think I naturally like stumbled across and stumbled through some of it, like the willpower, the stress, the movement, and then your career's taken from you, or you just, you know, Father Time says enough's enough. And, you know, a lot of former athletes are like, oh, I miss the locker room. I miss, you know, it's like, I miss the weight room and I miss the practice field. The game, you could keep the games, you could keep the locker room. Like, I want to be moving and I want to be out on the field and doing it with a group. And then you retire and all of a sudden I'm like, well, I guess I'm just destined to work out in my garage, and that's going to be it for connection for me for a while. And I think a lot of guys are like that. Do you find that more females are social worker outers than males are? Is there any percentages on that?
I don't know. I think probably if you were to look specifically at things like group fitness classes, at a gym or at a studio, you might see that difference. But in my experience, men are just as likely to want it. And also the research, but they might find it in recreational sports, like a pickup game, yeah, or joining a team. They might find it in a running club or training for events. My husband is an endurance athlete, and I know that there's some elements of connection that comes from training and helping people when you're out on the trail in some, ultra endurance run, and being a part of that community. And so I feel like the need to connect through movement is pretty, pretty universal. And movement is really good at helping people find connection for so many different ways that, the thing that it's funny, because when I started working on the movement book, I had my own experience, but I really was curious about all these different forms of movement that weren't a part of my life history, like racing and people who do adventure exercise. And
yeah,
I thought like, maybe this is something totally different. Maybe these people are experiencing something completely different than what I'm doing when I teach a group movement class. And what I found out is people just kept telling me about community and connection and feeling connected to something bigger than themselves. Even people who were out in nature on their own would talk about feeling connected to something bigger than themselves. And it seems like there's something about challenging your body, being in movement, engaging with life through your body, allows us to be a more social version of ourselves. It enhances things like cooperation and communication and empathy and collective joy, which is that, positive feeling of doing something with other people. It increases bonding, all of that. So, so I think it's not at all surprising to me that that's what you would miss the most from sports.
It was my drug of choice. And that's, I guess, how I got high. And you talk about in the book, runner's high. And I've always been so jealous. I can't run. I'm like a Clydesdale, I've got like thick ankles and squatty body, and I've just put myself through the ringer. So I can't run. I tried to run, my wife's running a marathon and I run 3 miles, and then I've got like Achilles pain and plantar fascia. Can you get runner? What is runner's high? Can it be measured with like chemicals in the blood? And can we get it by other means?
Isn't it funny? I love you saying that you're not a runner. I'm not a runner either. I don't know what it is about running. You have to train very specifically for it. Like, I can literally exercise all day as long as it's not running. But as soon as you ask me to run around the block, I'm like, I'm dying. So clearly you have to train for it. So the runner's high, let's move to a different label for it. You could call it an exercise high. I call it a persistence high. This is by the way, there's lots of ways to get a mood boost or to change your brain chemistry through movement. So the high is actually one like specific biochemical effect, but we could talk about a dozen different types of highs you can get from movement that are neurochemically different than like the classic exercise high. But the classic exercise high that is, it seems to be pretty reliable through running or jogging, is this change of brain chemistry that kicks in after about 20 minutes of continuous moderate effort movement. So something that gets your heart rate up, but it's not like what I was doing this morning where I was like, you know, heaving breathless, you know, pushing myself to the limits. It's, you pull it back from that. And what happens is your brain recognizes that you're doing something hard that requires effort and hopefully is connected to a goal. And when your brain recognizes that you're doing something that matters and is hard, and that the fact that it matters, that it's connected to a goal for you, is really important. If you hate exercise and you think the activity you're doing is stupid and pointless and you don't want to be doing it, you are literally inhibiting the exercise high. So you'd better figure out your why or find something that you actually want to do. That's a second story. So your brain's like, okay, we're doing something hard, requires effort, and it's connected to a goal. So let's release some brain chemicals that are going to give us energy, make effort easier, so it actually feels less effortful, facilitates this effort physically, and also makes us feel good and hopeful and optimistic so that we feel like we can reach our goal. That's the exercise high. And it's driven primarily by endocannabinoids, which are the brain chemicals that cannabis mimics. But it also includes things like dopamine and adrenaline, which give you that extra kind of like boost of power. And it also, because it's driven so much by endocannabinoids, it also facilitates that social connection. So endocannabinoids make us more social. They make things like cooperation and play and laughter and conversation and all of that feel better and help us feel closer to other people. So that's why like runners often form such like close bonds when they're running. But you can do it with anything. I get my most reliable exercise high in that flavor from flow yoga. Everything else I do, it's a different high that I'm accessing. It's like the super endorphin driven, adrenaline driven, testosterone driven, super high intensity, which I love, is really good medicine for me. It's a really good antidote to anxiety. And also the incredible endorphin rush of moving to music and expressing emotions that I get from teaching dance. So those are different types of high. Another high, by the way, I should say, that is also neurochemically different, is exercising in nature. And for some people, that's the best medicine.
Okay, so this is something that I've got to start paying attention to now, is what kind of high I'm getting.
Yeah.
So I didn't, you know, it's like, I know I feel good when I leave working out. And I'm like, wow, that was fantastic. And I'm like, life's better. I feel settled. You know, everything's at ease.
It's really supportive of like just feeling good. I call it like this energized optimism. So you can get it from a jog, from, you know, strength training, anything where you're just, you know, you're breaking a sweat, but you're not killing yourself. And you should feel afterwards, you should feel by the time you're doing 20 minutes, you should feel pretty good. Like, yeah, I want to keep doing this. I'm like, I'm feeling good about myself, good about life, good about the rest of the world. And then afterwards, you should be able to transfer that to other goals and relationships that matter to you. I mean, that's really what the medicine of the exercise high is it transfers. It doesn't like deteriorate 10 seconds after you take off your sneakers. You're going to be in that, that brain state sometimes for hours afterwards. There's this upward spiral. And so, you know, people have better interactions with friends and family and coworkers. They're more likely to make progress on important goals for them because they're still feeling optimistic and confident about their ability to tackle challenges. And so I think that's like a really good, if you're going to chase a high, it's a really good one to chase, because it's, you know, both physically in terms of what it takes out of you, it really just gives you more than it takes. And it also sets you up to be the best version of yourself. When we're talking about exercise for mental health, and you're looking at like real deep therapy for your brain to go along with whatever else you're doing, therapy or medication or meditation or whatever else you're doing, then I think that actually it can be useful to pull some other levers like high intensity or exercising outdoors or moving in groups or moving to music. Those are the other levers that I pull as a fitness professional in my own life.
Do you think we'll ever get to the place where certain brain types and certain personality types, I mean, you naturally, I guess, gravitate towards what you like and enjoy, but as pulling on like the lever as a prescription, say, hey, for this mood, this exercise form is probably better for you. Will we get there? Are we there?
I think people can do that for themselves. And some people are already doing it. But I think that, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about movement and exercise and finding forms that you really enjoy and are meaningful to you is there's not an endless variety. People tend to instinctively gravitate towards competition, play, cooperation, music, celebration, challenge and mastery, being outdoors, a sense of flow that is kind of spiritual. I mean, there's a few things that movement gives you. And what I always say is you should sort of forget, yes, movement has other benefits, like burning calories and changing body composition. We know that that is possible. But if you start from that, you can end up orchestrating workouts that are not also delivering the form of movement that is going to give you your ideal high and be really enjoyable and create the community you want. So since we know that like all movement is good for your physical health, I often, as a psychologist, I'm encouraging people to start with the question of, do I want to have an experience of competition? Do I want to have an experience of getting better at something hard and interesting? Do I want to lose myself in the music or the flow? Do I want to spend time with people who make me laugh and whose company I enjoy? Like, figure that out first. And that will often lead people to a workout that is like the right medicine or magic for them. And then you could also do a prescription kind of thing too. But that again, I think you can do for yourself. Like I discovered during when we had the first COVID shutdown, that was when I discovered I needed a much stronger dose of high intensity movement because I lost so much of the social community and being able to contribute in like to every day know that I was doing something that made a difference in people's lives. To have that stripped away so quickly, it was like that was my baseline mental health support. And I needed a form of movement that would be a strong antidote to the despair I was falling into as a result of not being able to contribute and not being able to connect. And I've kept it up. I was not somebody who did things like HIIT and my favorite Les Mills Grit. And now I'm doing it 3 times a week. And it's amazing. Well, you don't even have to suspend disbelief. It is real connection, but it's mediated through technology. So you're missing some things. So it's not the same. It can absolutely serve an important purpose of feeling connected and belonging. And also some of those technologies are accessing other forms of social things like identity, you know, like with like the hashtags that you might see on Peloton, or communal effort. I mean, you can absolutely sense that you're riding with hundreds of other people and feel like you're not alone in that, like wanting to quit and your legs are burning and you're going to keep going. So there's a lot of stuff that is real and valuable. It's not fake. It's supporting our sense of not being alone or of wanting to feel a positive identity around a form of exercise that's really good for us. So a lot of that is real and useful. The reason why I chose not to teach fitness over Zoom is because there is this other side of social exercise that is about being physically present with other people that includes the incredible contagion effect of positive emotion, whether it's persistence and pushing through and like screaming practically, or the joy of like doing a movement that is just pure celebration to a song that you love. And like last night I'm thinking about we were literally smashing guitars at the end of a song and of a big rock song. And it was just, and everyone's bursting into applause at the end of it. And it was this great catharsis. You don't get that over Zoom. You can't hear it. It doesn't reverberate in the cells of your body. You can't smell people's sweat. And we know that when we sweat, we release chemicals that signal who we are and the emotions we're feeling. And when you are in an environment where people are working out with purpose or with pleasure, their sweat actually enhances the experience for you and helps you find that same courage and joy. So I'm all about that. And those are the things where, and it, you know, I think you know whether that's important to you or not. And it's another one of those matching things. Some people, the ease of being able to get into a workout on technology, like their most meaningful social connections are going to be their family or their friends, the people they meet up with, you know, at the end of the day. And they just need a little bit of that social glue that makes the workout itself less aversive and more appealing. And then there are people like me who just really love the actual direct community. And the reason we're working out is for that type of social joy that you can't really get in a non-embodied way. So
that's exactly what I felt when I finally stepped foot into a group fitness gym and the lights were down and it was kind of like a club. And it was like, holy cow, like I can... it was just buzzing, right? It was like the energy of the place. I mean, there's probably so many senses that we've lost touch with over the years that we just like, you don't even know why you like it. It's just like, God, dog, this feels amazing. And you can get more out of yourself. So here, the question, one of the last questions I have on exercise is, how do we get more people to commit to exercise? Because it seems like that's the barrier. And you said it's, you know, having a goal, having like enjoying it is part of the process. And I think some people view exercise as punishment rather than pleasure. How do we break down those?
You do barriers? Have to adjust that mindset. And also you need to give your brain and your body time to actually experience what it's going to be like once you've committed. So really interesting research. I mean, so everyone understands if you've never run before, it's going to get easier physically to run if you run multiple times a week. Same thing with strength training. People understand that your muscles change and it's really hard to lift something heavy, but if you keep doing it, your muscles change in a way that make it easier and more enjoyable. Well, the same is true for how the brain understands the sensations of exercise, things like your heart rate increasing, breathing harder, sweating, the sensations of stretch, like in a yoga class. It takes about 6 weeks of regular exercise, so a few times a week, for your brain to start reliably rewarding you for exercise, giving you that exercise high, starting to interpret a lot of the sensations of effort and challenge as both uncomfortable and pleasurable. And when most people start exercising, right, their brains aren't there yet. So the first yoga class you go to, every stretch hurts and people often don't like it. The first exercise class they go to, their heart is pounding, they're sweating, they feel gross, they feel weak, they feel out of shape. Their brains don't yet know that it's a thrill to get your heart into that zone and to feel it pounding in your chest. So I feel like people don't talk about this enough, that your experience changes. And it may actually be really unfun and miserable in the beginning, and it doesn't stay that way. So I wish that more fitness professionals would talk to people about this and give them something to look forward to. Like people just say, oh, my brain doesn't work that way. I hate exercise. I'll never get an exercise high. Well, you won't until your brain learns to reward you for it. So that's part of it, is the give people something to look forward to get to that commitment. And in the meantime, what can you do to get some immediate reward from exercise while your brain and your body are adapting? And that's where things like find an activity you enjoy, you know, find an accountability partner, get the right playlist, because music makes movement easier and more enjoyable immediately. That's something you can do immediately to get a little bit of the adrenaline and dopamine and endorphins that your brain later on will give you, you know, in spades once it's used to exercising.
It's funny. On the introduction, I was like, you know, I used to listen to pump up music when I was working out, but I listen to books now, which I guess I've gotten to the point where I don't really need pump up music, I just know it's good and I like it. And it's like, this is, I get the juices going and then I feel like my brain absorbs all the information. But I think you're right. It's when you were talking about people need to understand that it gets easier. It's, I wish when I had kids that people would have told me how bad the first year sucked and would have braced me for impact instead of being like, you're going to love it. They're the light of your life. It's like, no, they suck for a year. They just suck. You're tired. You're exhausted. They cry. You can't communicate. There's like no feedback. It's just like a brick wall. And I'm just carrying this little thing around. So I wish more people would have done that. And I think an exercise, you're right. It's like, look how awesome it is, but health and fitness, eating right. I've been telling people those are like really long. It takes a long time to build up the proper reward system to reap the benefits from it just psychologically.
Yeah. So you have to think of it like, how are you going to support yourself through that? It's true. It's the same thing when your brain needs to adapt to enjoying different foods. Your brain needs to adapt whatever change you're trying to make. It's going to take time for your brain to catch up to understanding and appreciating positive changes. So what are you going to do to support yourself in that process? And it's, you know, figuring out a why that is really meaningful and motivating to you is a big part of that, that it has to be that you start to view movement or any sort of behavior change as coming from a clarity of who you want to be, how you want to experience life, what you want to contribute to the world. If a behavior change is not clearly connected to that, it's very hard to make that change. And also, it might not even be the right change. And I think I happen to believe that almost everyone will benefit from moving more. So I think that most people would be able to find a way to make that connection. It's not necessarily true with other types of behavior change. Things like resolutions people make. Sometimes people get into their head these ideas that they have to be a certain type of person, and it may or may not actually be something that will allow them to, you know, to live their values more fully.
It, you know, getting people through, and we're kind of coming up on the time of the year, right, where I'm sure countless people, a huge percentage of folks have given up on the New Year's resolutions or whatever. And when I'm working with my people in the weight loss program, you know, they're like, oh, you're lucky you got willpower, you got discipline. I'm like, I'm sure I was born with a certain level of that. Like, you come out a little bit how you are, and then through your experiences and what you've dealt with, maybe it's boosted up more in the decisions you make. Maybe it's boosted a little bit more, but I don't know. That's just like my thoughts on that. What's the truth on willpower? Is it nature, nurture, both? What are we looking at?
It's a little bit. We all have nature, and it is not just nurture, but like self-nurture. This idea that you can train different aspects of willpower like a muscle. You get better at it through the decisions you make and the discomfort that you're willing to tolerate. You know, when it comes to nature, so one thing I always point out to people is there are three really important aspects of what we could call willpower. There's the ability to control impulses and not give in to them. That's like won't power. I won't hit someone when I'm angry. I won't buy something when I can't afford it. I won't eat something that's bad for my health. There's that sort of like resisting temptation. But there's also the side of willpower that is about finding the energy to do things that are hard, even when you have self-doubt, anxiety, you're exhausted, you're in pain. It's that I will, and I will keep going. It's a different trait. And then there's I want power, which is clarity about your goals and values, and having such clarity that you really see choice points as meaningful. You're not in denial. You know that whether or not I smoke this cigarette matters. What I choose to spend my money on matters. If I procrastinate, it matters. When you have real clarity about what you want, what's really meaningful to you, it's a kind of vision that allows you to identify the choices that matter most. So I think people come into, you know, based on genetics and all of that, that you probably have one of those that's stronger than the other two. I know I actually have, I have really good won't power, and I've spent my whole life, like I can control myself, but yeah. I have to motivate myself. And that's, you know, part of the anxiety. And so I've had to cultivate, what does it mean to show up when you don't want to show up? What does it mean to keep going when you want to quit? Like, do you have an instinct which one was easiest for you, and what you've had two of those three?
Mine's won't for sure. Yeah. I mean, and I think it really got cultivated. I was a wrestler in high school and I lost 48 pounds my senior year to make weight. And it was just like, it wasn't a huge issue for me to not eat. I was like, no, I can't eat or I won't make weight. And so I'm not going to eat. That is the strongest for me. But you're right. I think the anxiety types, maybe the I will, like getting over the hurdle and keep going, maybe that's the hard part for us.
It is. And that's willpower too. And so sometimes when people are like, oh, you know, someone has willpower or not, it's such a weird judgment that doesn't understand that all human beings are struggling with impulses that they have to manage. And the other thing I'll say is, just sort of as a something that bugs me is when people look at individuals who struggle with addiction and think that that is a lack of willpower. Whether you are addicted to substances like the atypical, the way that we think of addiction, or you've been addicted to a behavior or coping strategy, if you've had that moment of trying to not give in to what your pattern is or what your craving is, you know that like every single time you do that, every minute you delay it, is an extraordinary act of willpower. And people who have ever had a true addiction have so much more willpower than people who have not found themselves in that situation because of what they often have to bring to difficult moments of craving or stress or exhaustion. And so I do feel like that's another way that people think about this and they're getting it really wrong. Willpower is not about it being easy to do things that are consistent with your goals and your values. Willpower is about being able to do things that are hard, but to find a way to make that choice that puts your values and your goals first.
I think it's a really unique and interesting perspective on willpower and addiction. I just had a obesity doctor on, and you know, like the thing we see on Instagram all the time is like, you got to be disciplined, you got to be hard, you got to be. And it's like, yeah, but some of these folks have no say in this. You know, it's like their brains are wired differently, and sure, they can use some of the tools and everything. And it's just like, come at it from a place of understanding and empathy that, like you said, that one decision must feel like a month for them of abstaining from a minute, you know, and we're all wired differently. So have a little empathy for those. And then I guess be grateful if you do have good willpower.
Yeah. People who are in the position of helping others should ask themselves, what's the hardest thing you've ever done in your entire life? And then imagine every person you're helping, the thing that you're helping them with is that. Like, I mean, you know, really have some empathy and some imagination.
How should people, because we all have setbacks, right? Everybody's got a setback. And I think a lot of us naturally like have dad or mom voice in our head. It's like, you're an idiot. What are you doing? Clean that up. Do this. Why'd you do that? It's like, what's the most effective way we can talk to ourselves?
Yeah. Well, so you should also think like, who's the best mentor or coach you've ever had? Or maybe it's someone maybe you've never had it, but you can pull it from, entertainment, some movie, TV show, book. You have to learn to mentor yourself. And in a way, it requires a kind of distance from yourself. So when you hear people talk about things like self-compassion or self-coaching, you often hear people talk about it as if there's two versions of you. There's the version of you that's kind of small and stuck in the moment, experiencing self-doubt or self-criticism. And then there's some part of you that has the wisdom of a bigger perspective. Maybe it's the part of you who can imagine your future self having overcome this obstacle, or it's the you that also is looking back with gratitude and appreciation for the ways that you have grown and changed and the things you've endured, and really like trusts you to be able to overcome this moment. And so, you know, the best way to talk to yourself is to figure out who that person is, the part of you who has some perspective. And there's really interesting research. If you're literally talking about self-talk, the benefits of talking to yourself in the second person rather than the first person. So in the way that like the critic says, you're so stupid, like you have to use that kind of you language, that externalize it a little bit. Like, Kelly, wow, I can tell you're feeling really disappointed. you think you let other people down. I can see how hard you're being on yourself in this moment, but like you've got to take a breath and take a step back. I know you did your best. You tried really hard, and it's not like this is forever. You get another chance tomorrow. I don't know. I'm just making this stuff up, but
yeah,
this talking to yourself, finding the self to self relationship. There's nothing weird about that. You should totally try it.
That's cool. Kelly, try that. That's cool. That's because I want my boys to be able to speak to themselves with compassion and kindness and love. Right. And I don't, if they hear me speaking to them a certain way, they're going to model it the way they talk to themselves. So those are great things. All right. I don't want to keep you much longer. What's the book you're working on and what kind of timeline we looking at and where are we at in the process? Years.
Well, so I'll tell you that where the inspiration for that, who knows if this book is even going to happen. Exactly. There are many, many books I've worked on that did not become books. Usually takes me a couple of years to figure out what the next book is, because it has to be, for me, it has to be something where there's really compelling science that nobody has written about yet or written about well. That's sort of like the first rule. Because otherwise, why does it need to be a book? Book is like, books are information dense, I feel like. And so they're, for me, they're translating science into strategy. So the reason that I started working on the current project is I found that in doing a lot of podcasts and interviews during COVID, I would be talking about my previous books and somehow we would end up talking about something else, which is, like, how do you deal with difficult emotions? What does it mean when you're lonely? What do you do with grief? What do you do with overwhelming anxiety? And I found that we kept having these really interesting conversations about emotions. And, you know, my primary training is as an emotions researcher and how emotions work in your brain and your body and how do we manage them? So that's sort of broadly the topic of the book that I'm working on, but you know, books are an interesting thing. You don't really know what they're going to be until you've been working on them for quite a while.
Well, keep it up. I mean, I love it. I love the translation. I love the science into the stories and all of those melding together. I think you do a beautiful job and we're very fortunate that you're in our world. So keep up your good work. All the effort is greatly appreciated. Who are you reading? Who are you following? Where are you getting your information? Who interests you?
So where I get my information, this is not going to be maybe something everyone wants to do, but Google Scholar. So if you're serious, you know, if your audience is serious about getting fast, you know, cutting edge information, go to scholar.google.com and set some alerts for yourself. I get sent hundreds of studies to me every day based on the topics that I'm interested in. And that's where I get my information. It's the studies that are being published every day. Even if you're not trained to go and read scientific articles, it might even be worth trying it. Even if you're just sort of casually interested, you can read the titles, you can read the abstract, you can get a sense of what people are doing. You will have a totally different perspective on the world than if you're waiting for people like me to spend 5 years writing a book about it.
Because it does. It takes an incredibly long time. Beautiful cat, by the way. Yeah. Well, Kelly, thank you so very much for this time and for all the time I've spent with you on my headphones, listening while I'm working out and reading the books. Normally I buy the audiobook, and then if I really like it, I actually get the hard copy just to keep on my shelf. It's like, I read that one. That was an important one. One last question. Why didn't you read the first one?
Oh, they wouldn't let me. I volunteered to. I was a nobody. Back then, they were like, I don't think we want to let this, you know, random psychology instructor read her audiobook. Let's hire a professional. By the time the second book came out, they were much more amenable to letting authors read their own books.
It just seems so much more authentic. I like it.
I totally agree. I totally agree. I love hearing authors read books themselves because there is so much, you can feel their passion. I will tell you, as much as I've heard that the person who read The Willpower Instinct is great, the feedback I've gotten consistently is that he doesn't seem to have a lot of compassion for the reader. And that's what makes me sad. because that book was really written with a lot of empathy for the struggles we all have. And apparently his delivery is a little snarkier than my sort of baseline empathy. So
he's like Alex Trebek.
Is that right?
R.I.P. Alex, you know, on Jeopardy, Alex.
He was really empathic, wasn't he?
I don't know. I always felt like he acted like he knew all the answers. And he was like, you should.
Technically, he did.
I mean, he did. Yeah, he did know the answers to the test before it came out. Maybe at some point you can go back and reread the original. And then it'll be like the second edition. And
it's then we'll a 10-year anniversary, so maybe.
All right. Well, Kelly, thank you so very much.
Okay, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.